Chicago. This is Bruce Dumont with our Beyond the Beltway analysis of national politics, featuring occasional injections of rumor and innuendo, all offered up by a panel of political insiders, pundits, power brokers, public servants, professors, and most importantly, plain-speaking Americans from coast to coast. Tonight featuring commentary by Clifford Kelly, Kitty Kurth, Dan Miller, and Ed Bernayne. Our program tonight coming to you from our home base at the Museum of Broadcast Communications in Chicago, where our toll-free lines are open at 1-800-723-8289. That's 1-800-723-8289. If you'd like to email us a comment, it's Bruce Dumont at museum.tv. If you'd like to tweet us a comment, it's at Dumo, at D-U-M-O. And this is tonight, the 35th anniversary of this broadcast. And again, as the program unfolds this evening, don't go to your dial if you think this is just going to be a flashback and a lot of memories. It's not going to be about that. Because this past week, I would say, might be one of the most monumental weeks in the history of this program. And so we're going to talk about contemporary issues that are less than several days old in many cases. Throughout the second hour, we'll talk a little bit about some of the monumental subjects and political shifts in the winds that have taken place over the last 35 years. And I'm very happy to have as my guests on this program four people who are very special to me. They have played an integral role in the history and the unfolding of this program. But again, they'll be talking about contemporary politics. We'll maybe reminisce a little bit in hour number two. But again, of all of the major things that happened, I'm going to start with you, Kitty Kurth. Of all the things that happened just last week with Supreme Court decisions on Obamacare and same-sex marriage, the president's speech in Charleston, the terrorism that took place on Bloody Friday, what was the one moment that stood out to you from a political standpoint?
From a political standpoint, I think it would have to be the equal rights decision, the marriage equality decision. From a personal standpoint, the health, because I'm a small business person, the healthcare decision. But I think both are really, really monumental. And if President Obama was worried about his legacy, I think he doesn't really have to worry anymore.
Ed Bernayne is one of our card-carrying Republicans. Ed, what answer would you give to that question?
I think I would reverse the order that Kitty gave. I think the equal rights, the gay movement, the successes that have been had are not really going to change things much from where they were. Because I think that that part of society was living and doing what it was going to do, and the people are going to be able to do it without pressures on them. I think the health care is something that is going to have a much more lasting impact and is probably going to attract more attempts or effort to reverse it at some point down the line.
Clifford Kelly, one of our Democrats, one of the original panel members of this program.
Well, first I have to thank you because this is the person who made me a talk show host.
Well,
yeah, Thursday.
Because you were a great guest.
Thursday nights on WBZ, unbelievable. And congratulations to you for 35 years,
thank you.
I'm so happy to have been a part of it. Yeah. I would agree the Affordable Care Act because I think that has such an impact on so many people. And there's going to be a lot more attempts to change that. I think the Republicans probably dodged a bullet on this because of the fact that the Supreme Court came out with the decision, and so they don't have to really come up with an alternative. If the Supreme Court had gone the other way, then they'd have to be saying—
Did they dodge the bullet on both issues, on both decisions, to some extent?
I'm not sure on the other.
Dan Miller joins us, also a longtime frequent guest. Once upon a time, a Republican, but more of a libertarian these days. Go ahead, Dan.
I don't know where to begin, Bruce. The Republicans had alternatives all over the place, Cliff. They would have no problem coming up with more alternatives if Obamacare. But to answer your question,
big story
was Obamacare, not because of the efforts that's going to be made now to repeal it, but because of what the court did in interpreting a a very badly written law and writing it, rewriting it themselves to say, well, this is what Congress really meant. As clumsy as they were, this is what they meant. My gosh, that is virtually unprecedented by the Supreme Court.
Now, let me go through a couple of things, because a lot of people were denouncing the Supreme Court, cheering the Supreme Court. And so from a political standpoint, we all know that in the history of this program, every 4 years, a portion of that campaign is about, well, remember, they're going to appoint the next people to the Supreme Court. But here is, you know, wherever you are, probably on the conservative end of this discussion, but here's some things to remember. Justice Roberts, the Chief Justice, was nominated by George W. Bush. He is the guy who's been vilified as sort of the father of Citizens United, which the Democrats would like to have some sort of a constitutional convention to overturn. So the left is out there wanting to, you know, usurp the decision by the Supreme Court. There's already a call by some of the Republican presidential candidates. They want a constitutional amendment overturning the same-sex marriage decision. And by the way, Justice Kennedy, who is at the moment the darling of the gay rights movement in the United States, he was nominated by Ronald Reagan, and he voted with the majority in Bush v. Gore in 2000, which awarded the presidency to George W. Bush. So you never know what you're going to get when you
it's
nominate.
It's like a box
Supreme
of chocolates,
Court.
Isn't it?
I think that's true, and I think there is no 10 question page that they have to check yes or no on, that then goes to the public and then goes to the Congress for
When Roberts was being questioned in his nomination procedure, he very distinctly said a Supreme Court justice should be the umpire. He shouldn't decide the outcome of the game. He should be the umpire. Well, he completely abrogated that idea in the Obamacare issue.
At our house, we had this discussion this morning, though. If we kind of hate about half the things the Supreme Court does, and we hate and we love about half the things, that probably means they're getting things right. That probably means they're fulfilling. Exactly.
Right.
Yeah. And the Founding Fathers were so smart to have the Supreme Court, the legislature, and the presidency. It works. It works well. You might be mad at it this week, but next week you'll be happy about it.
The only
one.
And the other thing is, and we've known this for the last 25 years, is that both sides can use Supreme Court decisions to raise a lot of money and rally their base.
Correct. The only justice I've seen that's really gotten a lot of pushback was Thomas.
Ernest Thomas.
Yeah, because he only got 52.
The most qualified man to be the Supreme Court justice, according to George Herbert Walker Bush.
Absolutely. Four of the senators who voted for him within a year and a half said they would not have if they had known what he was, because they saw he didn't do anything but whatever Scalia said. Yeah, that's right. But that he never asks any questions and he never does anything. So
he listens, Cliff. You ought to try it sometime. I mean, as a talk show host, that's not really
part of his thing. But he never writes. You know, he hasn't written
He wrote a dissent in all of these cases right now. He also agreed with that.
Has there ever been a decision that he hadn't agreed with Scalia?
I don't know. I don't follow it.
I don't think
closely.
So. I think Scalia gives him,
Anyway, 1-800-723-8289 from coast to coast and border to border. You can pick any one of the monumental subjects we've already discussed. In a normal week, we would also have spent a great deal of time, and we will before this program ends, about the president's eulogy with Reverend and State Senator Pinckney in Charleston, South Carolina. It was a monumental moment, I think, in the history of civil rights in this country, and we'll talk about that as the program unfolds this evening. I'm Bruce Dumont.
Honey, what's the best vacation we've ever had?
This one.
Bradenton, Anna Maria Island, Longboat Key. Real, authentic, Florida. Plan to visit online at BradentonGulfIslands.com.
A great moment from the Beyond the Beltway archives.
Let's get to the big, big story, and that is the fall of the Communist Party. Tom Roser?
It was the liberals which were saying, well, we've got to stand by Gorbachev. I know why Democratic liberals like Gorby. It's because he reminds
and George
us
Bush.
Of the little Duke.
Ray,
this guy
attacked.
Is a guy who went to the Soviet Union and, in fact, when he was captured, didn't
Believe
do anything.
You.
So that's why he looks like the little Duke to them.
Beyond the Beltway with Bruce Dumont, still going strong after 35 years.
1-800-723-8029 is the telephone number, 1-800-723-8029. I mentioned before the break that the president's eulogy last Friday in Charleston, I think, was monumental. I want to get reaction. Cliff, let me begin with you.
I think it was great. That's the best speech I've heard him make since the Democratic National Committee, convention, rather. And he was... excellent. I don't think there's anything better that he could have done.
I want to talk about the broader issue again. That this we talked about this last week on the program when it was shortly after the shooting. It was first one of the first national shows to talk about the shooting. And I mentioned last week that really what was on display was really Christianity was on display. The way in which those that were the parents and relatives of the victims were speaking in such a forgiving mood when they went to the arraignment of the shooter, that it was such a strong juxtaposition to the way in which there have been actions, whether it's in Missouri or in Maryland, that even those that were guests on the Sunday morning shows, they didn't want to go into a political discussion, even on issues of the flag, where the national reporters wanted to go there. In fact, I said I thought there was almost a discomfort that some of the reporters had because these people were talking in such with such strong Christian beliefs of forgiveness. And what reminded me also was the way in which the shootings and the church bombing in 1963 brought the death of those school children and those churchgoers in 1963. It alerted a nation. It brought a sympathy. It brought a compassion from the broader community. But it was really about the death of people that were killed while they were worshiping. And I see a similarity in the way that maybe America can move on from this. And I thought the president sort of seized the moment, at least with his rhetoric the other day. Dan, do you put that degree of importance on this maybe watershed moment in race relations?
No, I don't, Bruce. Okay. I agree with Cliff that this was the finest speech that Obama has made. It was just pitch perfect. But no, the racial issue has been so divisive and so much part of our DNA for so many decades and generations.
Are you surprised that there was such a fast movement, Ed, on the Confederate flag issue, led by a Republican governor of South Carolina?
Well, I think the issue has been bubbling for some time, and I think this was one of those things that just kind of pushed it over the top.
Right.
And some public officials, and I think that she was one of them, the governor was one, who felt that we have to say something, we have to do something. And it was a matter of the opportunity was there, and we better react. We better do something.
I think Ed is completely right. I think it was an issue that's been being pushed for a long time, and Governor Haley wisely saw that this was the straw that broke the camel's back. But I think you also have to look at Charleston a little bit individually. They've been working on reconciliation, and they've been working together as a community for years and years and years under Mayor Riley and under a lot of the other local leaders. And I think that's one of the reasons why they were so surprised that this happened in their city, because they had been working
but
so
wasn't
hard.
From that
he
city.
Wasn't from there. That's right. The key. It wasn't someone from their city. Right. This wasn't how their city worked. And I think that's why also there was peaceful and forgiving reaction afterwards.
But in
people
each of
were
the
used
cases,
to reconciliation.
In Birmingham and Charleston, the point I'm making is the face of the victims was very obvious. There was a Christianity associated with
yes.
it. And the evilness and the symbolism of those that created the act, whether it was the Ku Klux Klan in 1963 mm-hmm. or this, you know, wacko who was in love
descendant
with the
Confederate. And
I think that I agree with you on there, Bruce, because he specifically said why he did it.
Yes.
Right.
Because he wanted to cause a race war.
Right.
And for the people to know that and to react as they did. And don't forget, when you see these people, the governor is an Indian American.
Yes, right.
The one African American U.S. senator we have is from there, Scott. So they've done some great things. But you know, as I was talking to one of the editorialists on my show, it's funny how things click in. I remember driving down Gervais Street. The fact that I even remember this, and see the Confederate flag flying on top of the dome. And she told me, well, that's true, but it's moved now. It's over
Charleston, you mean?
It was
taken off the dome and put in a park
right,
next
right.
door.
Right, right. But I remember seeing that years ago. I was at Fort Bragg, and I would go. But what that – and that didn't come back until the 60s. That was to say, screw the U.S.
Right.
During the demanding of desegregation of the schools. They weren't pushing this the whole time.
Yeah.
That's where it moved from a legitimate historic battle flag – of part of America that basically lost the Civil War, and it became a political symbol that was used for those who were seeking
It still is recognized by the U.S. Army as a legitimate battle flag.
Yes.
There are people who are going to insist that they be able to put it on. They're going to cite their First Amendment rights. This is going to be a more divisive issue by making the flag so important, the Confederate flag.
As Nikki Haley said, in private, it's fine.
And
if
also
you want
in
to
a
do
museum,
it on your private house or in a museum.
And it should be in a museum. I think the issue here is, does it belong on state property? I think that's the issue.
I would say it probably doesn't belong on state property.
Right.
We have a flag with red and white stripes and blue stars or blue and white stars, and that's our flag, and that's what belongs on state property. I think the Confederate flag has a place in history.
Yes.
I also think, though, that over the last 5 years, 10 years, there has been a much greater awareness of the militant religion or religion as a cause. Or maybe it's not religion, but if you look and see what is happening, particularly in the Mideastern countries and the threats that are coming over here, are people looking at religion with a different viewpoint or a different eye than they have in the past?
Well,
I think we're all a little bit more sensitive to that.
Well,
and
it's something else that's important about what happened last Friday, because you had the country was reacting to the Supreme Court decision on Obamacare. The president was going to Charleston. It was the same day the Supreme Court decision early in the morning came out on same-sex marriage. And on three continents, over 39 people were massacred by mm-hmm. ISIS, some of them directly related to ISIS. Mm-hmm. And in one case, 11 people were worshiping in a mosque in Kuwait City. They were worshiping to their God, just like those that were involved in the prayer meeting in Charleston, and they were both brutally attacked.
In my spare time, I spend a lot of time studying the rise of hate movements around the world, and I'm sorry to report that the people on the hate side of things, whether it's Islamic or anti-racist, anti-immigrant, they're all so much better networked than the people on the human rights side of the equation. It's frightening. And in fact, the young man who killed the people in Charleston was visiting the same websites and looking at the same things that Anders Breivik, who killed those kids in Norway on the island 5 years ago. They're all part of the same network.
Right. And that's the big fear of security forces all over the world now, is the way in which ISIS is using social media. At the beginning of the program, I talked that periodically we would talk about some monumental shifts in politics that have occurred in the history of this program over the last 35 years. This program went on the air on June 26th of 1980, which is last Thursday. We went on as a Thursday night show. Mm-hmm. 25 or 35 years later, that's when the Supreme Court decision on gay same-sex marriage came down, and the president gave the eulogy in Charleston, and there was the terrorism around the world. But less than a month after this program went on, yours truly went to, of all places, Detroit, Michigan, to Joe Louis Arena. And it was in Detroit, Michigan, that the Reagan Revolution began, and here's a little cut of what it sounded like.
July 16th, 1980 is a day that not many people in this auditorium will ever forget. For on this night, delegates from all over the United States gathered to endorse the candidacy of Ronald Reagan, nominated with 1,939 votes from this convention floor, the Joe Louis Arena in Detroit, Michigan. And what we see here today perhaps is the beginning of a new wave as we move into the 1980s. The Republicans throughout this convention has referred to this as their 1932, the turning point in American political history. Perhaps the story is being written here this evening. This certainly is chapter one.
You re-recorded that.
No, that was it.
That was very perceptive.
That's exactly where it was. Ed Bernayne, one of your claims to fame, you worked for Ronald Reagan. You were on the Reagan bandwagon early. You were an advance man for the president. Your reflection on the first major wave that happened in the history of this program, and that was the Reagan Revolution.
Well, it seemed, I think, to a lot of us at the time that we Americans, Republicans, got to a point where we were going to be able to continue for year after year and election after election. And I think that that feeling was strengthened, that the country was going in the right direction. I think, and certainly with no ill will towards towards President Carter, I think Americans just did not feel that he was leading them. You know, it was bundle up, put your sweater on if it gets too cold out there. And I think that Americans felt, and we felt certainly, that this was the beginning of something that was going to continue to grow. And it did grow with the following election when George H.W. Bush was elected. And then, as so many things happen, things turn around.
We will talk more about that when we continue on the 35th anniversary broadcast of Beyond the Beltway.
A great moment from the Beyond the Beltway archives.
July 16th, 1980 is a day that not many people in this auditorium will ever forget. For on this night, delegates from all over the United States gathered to endorse the candidacy of Ronald Reagan, nominated with 1,939 votes from this convention floor, the Joe Louis Arena in Detroit, Michigan. And what we see here today perhaps is the beginning of a new wave as we move into the 1980s. The Republicans throughout this convention has referred to this as their 1932, the turning point in American political history. Perhaps the story is being written here this evening. This certainly is chapter one.
Beyond the Beltway with Bruce Dumont, still going strong after 35 years.
Back in Chicago, 1-800-723-8029 from coast to coast and border to border. Tonight, celebrating our 35th anniversary on the air. And again, I think I may have mentioned this to some people, but perhaps not listening to those or those listening in the national audience. This program went on the air as a 13-week experiment to cover the 1980 presidential election. Jimmy Carter, the incumbent, was being challenged by Ted Kennedy. Ronald Reagan and George Bush and John Anderson were fighting it out for the Republican nomination. I thought it was a good time to do a show by, for, and about political junkies. And the general manager of the public radio station in Chicago, Carol Nolan, said, all right, let's give it a try. 13 weeks, and again, it's now 35 years later. And again, we should also mention that it began as a program called Inside Politics. But again, when we switched the show nationally in 1991, we were a national show for about 1 week, and the story that broke was the Anita Hill, Clarence Thomas, brouhaha, or the Clarence Thomas hearings. So everyone in America was politicized immediately. And again, it goes back to Carol Nolan, who gave this program an opportunity. We eventually went to commercial radio, and the rest is history. And hopefully it's been part of your Sunday night. We switched over to Sunday nights when we moved to WLS back in 1989. 82 or whatever it was. I forgot the year when did it. Right now, I'm going to introduce our guests or let them introduce themselves, and we're going to begin with, they're all old-time friends of mine this evening, and I'm delighted to have them around the table, not only tonight, but for many, many weeks over the last 35 years. Clifford Kelly.
Yeah, I'm a former member of the City Council. I have a radio show now. And I am a student of this wonderful gentleman because when I think about all of the things, what you have done, not only relative to getting out, disseminating information, but I remember walking with you through some theaters that you were trying to,
yep.
with before mice running museum. Around. Yep. Yeah, before yep. the museum. And I'm
I
just
believe a, they were rats.
They were. They were rats.
Big ones.
Yeah, they certainly were. You're absolutely right. But I just want to commend you, and I appreciate being here. But you've done a wonderful, wonderful job.
Thank you very much. Dan Miller.
I met Bruce in about 1982 or 3 because I was a business editor for a local newspaper. And he was getting involved with the Museum of Broadcast Communications, which seemed like a great job. And my claim to fame and Bruce's affection for me stems from the fact that I introduced him to Rance Crane, who led to the some part of the financing that brought the Major. Museum of Broadcast Communications into existence. And if you've never been to Chicago to see the Museum of Broadcast Communications, you've got to make it a spot on your itinerary. It is fun.
Dan, thank you. It was the pivotal meeting in the history of the museum and something else at a very important moment in the history of this program early on when there was very little support and you were with a company called City and State.
Mm-hmm.
You provided some support and some funding, which allowed this program to continue because the nationalization of this program was built on a foundation of state capital markets where people who lived in state capital markets were interested in politics and interested in a perspective. And so, again, a very valuable contribution that you made. And Kitty Kurth, it's your turn.
My name is Kitty Kurth. I own Kurth Lampe Worldwide. We do politics and strategic consulting. And when I moved back to Chicago in 1982, I met Phil Krohn, who was a longtime show member of Inside Politics. And he said, well, you know, if you're interested in politics, you have to listen to this show. And I tuned in and they said, rumor and innuendo. And I was like, that is my kind of show. And a couple years later, I was helping Cliff with one of his campaigns. Right. And then I got to meet the Bruce Dumont in person, which was very thrilling at the time.
And still is.
And later worked, got the pleasure to work with you on some of the early stuff at the Museum of Broadcast sure. Communications. And, you know, too real, as a student of history, Beyond the Beltway, Inside Politics, and the Museum of Broadcast Communications are all huge right. in the history of the city of Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Ed Murnane.
Well, I knew Phil Krohn, and I also knew Phil Crane.
That's right.
I began working when he was a member of Congress. I had been a newspaper political editor, the Daily Herald now,
right.
and ended up spending time with Phil as a candidate and was talked into moving to Washington and taking a position with him after I was selected as a congressional fellow. I spent time with Phil. I got to know the people who were involved in Ronald Reagan's campaign, one of the campaigns that he had. I got very involved in that campaign, and after he was elected in 1980, after he had lost to Gerry Ford in the Republican primary, I became very close to them, ended up working for President Reagan, and became even closer to his vice president, George H.W. Bush. Spent time at the White House with President Bush and managed the last Republican victory, presidential victory in Illinois. I managed the Bush campaign in 19 whatever year that was.
You're Mr. Reagan Republican.
and for the last 20 so years before I just recently retired, I was the head of an Illinois organization, the Illinois Civil Justice League, which is primarily a tort reform organization that still fights.
By the way, let me mention that our phone number is 1-800-723-8020. We're getting some reports that they're getting busy signals. So, again, if we're getting calls, let's send them up. We'll take a call in just a moment. But
Bruce,
may I say just one thing?
Go ahead.
Cliff.
Inside Politics. Immediately, we was just shocked. You walk down LaSalle Street, and everybody was talking about, oh, heard you on inside politics. It was amazing.
We didn't think anybody was listening.
That's right.
We thought it was five people around.
Exactly.
And people said outrageous things.
No, right. And when I was finally cool enough to be on the show, I was so surprised because more people would talk to me about being on Inside Politics than any other radio or television appearance I've ever done.
I don't want to go too much further. And again, we're going to do this more in the second hour because I do want to get back to some of the discussions that we're talking about. But again, in the early days of the program, you mentioned Phil Krohn. Phil Krohn was on the very first show along with Tom Roser.
Tom Roser.
Who became a regular on the program. Right. Both have passed away, as well as another regular, Sheldon Gardner, who went on the judgeship. But Tom and Grace, they were the political Bickersons. They were a left-right combination. They were dynamic. They frequently sparred on the air, and they frequently sparred off the air. It wasn't even as friendly off the air as some of the other relationships. But again, it was a magic time. And again, they were
and
very
both,
special people.
Both brilliant.
And oh, speaking absolutely. Of late Tom Roser, who again.
Right.
He was on this program more than anyone else, over 650 appearances in the history. He also went on to become a talk show host in his own right on WLS Radio. Mm-hmm. But again, we're going to play a brief clip now about an explosion that took place between Tom Roser and then U.S. Congressman Mel Reynolds. Now, last week, the former congressman who had already been indicted and been imprisoned, he was indicted again last week for income tax evasion. But he was a controversial member of Congress, and he came in one night, and he did battle inadvertently with Tom Roser, and it sounded like this.
Does pay all his bills, Mr. Reynolds, for his campaign.
Like most people
and a lot
do.
Of other,
like
unlike
most
you.
People do. Like,
unlike you.
That's a lie.
That is not a lie, and
that's
you
a,
owe
that,
a lot
that,
of money,
that,
and I think
lie.
It's wonderful.
I owe $30,000.
This is the American
system. I owe
$30,000.
How much do you owe?
It goes all the way back. It goes
owe?
All the way back to when you
How
went to Harvard.
How much do you owe to? How much do you owe?
I don't know a thing.
I owe $30,000.
Gentlemen.
To Harvard.
Is that too much?
Gentlemen.
You've been taking credit.
That was a cheap, underhanded shot, and you ought to be ashamed of yourself.
It was an overhanded shot.
That was a cheap, underhanded shot, and you ought to be ashamed of yourself,
Why?
Roser.
Why?
Because you're a cheap
How
shot
How much do you owe Harvard?
I owe Harvard.
How much do you owe Harvard?
$14,000.
Well, pay it, will you? How
I'll
much
pay,
do you make?
I'll pay it.
$125,000?
I'll pay when I get around to paying it.
How much do you make?
I'll pay it when I get around to paying it.
Okay, that's the spirit. That's
I'll
the
pay
girl.
It when I get around to paying it. Just
like
everybody else did.
Doesn't
I wasn't rich like you, Roser, when I went to school.
I'll
I was
tell
poor.
You about who was
okay,
rich.
I wasn't a fat cat from Evanston
oh,
like
yeah?
you are. You
is
understand
that right?
That?
I'm from Park Ridge now.
That's
where
you're
blue
born itself. In Evanston.
Pay yeah, your bills.
I'm not a fat cat Republican.
This is why we don't get anywhere in this
this
country.
Not a
we
fat got cat
this,
Republican like this, you, Rosa.
This, taking pop shots yeah, at each other
while
the country
burns. Shot
well, hold on. Everybody, back. This is Inside Politics, the voice of reason coming from the Midwest. Ed,
yes.
You got your second point,
okay,
and,
my second
and we'll let
point,
Mr. Andrade and Mr. Polsby respond to whatever you say.
My second point is this, and I'm going to take all you guys on this, and that is that we need a gasoline tax. We pay less for our gasoline than anybody in the world. We do not pay for what we use. We don't.
Here's a guy calls up. He wants to talk about gasoline tax.
That'll teach him.
I would say, by the way, to put this in context, Mel Reynolds was a Rhodes Scholar. He ran for office. He got a lot of financial support. He clearly was one of the darlings, one of the rising stars of the Democratic Party in Cook County. He was on the Ways and Means Committee. His star was soaring. I don't think there's probably any local political leader who fell so fast and so often as Mel Reynolds.
I completely agree, and it was, and I think that's what was so hard about it was because everybody did put so much stock in him. And I'm going to say that I think some of the problems that Barack Obama had early in his political career was people were afraid that he was going to be another Mel Reynolds.
Yeah.
When he ran for Congress, I think that
Almost
was part of the problem.
The resume
exactly.
was
too good
to be
true.
The one
exactly.
thing, though, I love Tom Roser. We used to get into it, as you remember.
On and off the air.
That's true. That's true. But particularly, guys and lady, when we would have the program out somewhere, remember it?
Yes.
Yeah. Yes, sir, Senator. What was the name of that restaurant?
Barney's Market.
Barney, yeah. And we'd have a few drinks. Yeah.
By the way, I think Aaron Schock might give Mel Reynolds a run for quickly falling and crashing. Right. Now, whether it's going to be serial,
and having so much promise, but having so much promise,
actually,
so much promise
in Chicago with telephone calls, I promise.
Honey, what's the best vacation we've ever had?
This one.
Bradenton, Anna Maria Island, Longboat Key. Real, authentic, Florida. Plan to visit online at BradentonGulfIslands.com.
A great moment from the Beyond the Beltway archives.
Does pay all his bills, Mr. Reynolds, for his campaign.
Like most people.
And a lot of, unlike you.
That's a lie.
That is not a lie, and that's you owe a lot of money, and I think it's wonderful.
I owe $30,000.
This is the American
system. I owe $30,000. How much do you owe?
I don't know a thing.
That was a cheap, underhanded shot, and you ought to be ashamed of yourself.
That was an overhanded shot. Right over.
You ought to be ashamed of yourself, Rosa.
How much do you owe Harvard?
$14,000.
Well, pay it, will you? How much do you make?
I'll pay it. $125,000? I'll get around to paying it.
Beyond the Beltway with Bruce Dumont. Still going strong after 35 years.
Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Let's go to calls. Let's go to Jim listening to us on WCGO AM 1590. Go ahead, Jim.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. It's nice to have all the old guys back together. And thanks so much for playing Tom Roser. He was my political godfather during those days.
He was terrific. He got everybody's blood flowing, including my own. Go ahead.
No, he was a great guy.
He sure was.
He was gone. In fact, you know, he would save his energy at the end all week so he could do his radio show at nighttime on Sundays.
I know.
Yeah, it was amazing. But Obamacare, you know, is a disaster, and I know Mr. Murnane and I were on the same page as far as tort reform. Rather than screwing up the whole medical industry, they should have passed tort reform nationally like they did in Texas, and you'd have the same results, because what they did in Texas, they took the tort tax out of a lot of medical procedures and also allowed the malpractice premiums for doctors to not go through the roof, allowing people to stay in business. And Texas shows the way, and that should have been done if Obamacare.
Jim, right now, let's look ahead. The Supreme Court has voted. We know what their decision is. There's a myriad of people that are Republicans that want to be president of the United States. Of that vast field that is out there, who, in your view, is most likely to represent your position and get elected?
On Obamacare?
On any issue, but let's focus on Obamacare. I mean, the point is, they can rail against, which we talked about in segment one. They can rail against the Supreme Court, but what are they going to do?
Well, I think Ted Cruz would be great, and Ben Carson, his record is...
But Ted Cruz, excuse me for saying this, but Ted Cruz and Ben Carson, neither one of them is going to be the next president of the United States. I mean,
well,
I think you can go to the bank on that. Ted Cruz may win the Republican nomination, and I say may, and I would put him at maybe a very, very long shot. In my view, he's not the top five people that is most likely to be the Republican nominee. So who else, I mean, other than beating a dead horse and fighting yesterday's lost battle, which a lot of Republicans like to do, what do you do to move forward? Ed, do you have some advice?
I don't think Ted Cruz is going to be the Republican nominee.
No.
I don't know. I mean, the field, I brought a stack of papers so I could remember who his candidate is. And if one of you were to ask me who has announced already on the Republican side, I couldn't say that. Yeah. I'm very interested, and this doesn't get to the question, I'm very interested in Carly Fiorina. Mm-hmm. And the reason I'm interested in her is she becomes a counter to Hillary Clinton if Hillary Clinton becomes the nominee.
That would be kind of exciting.
It would be different.
It would be kind of exciting.
I don't know who. People ask me, because of my close connection with the family and the fact that I know them all, what about Jeb Bush and a lot of the folks that I worked in the White House? They're all with Jeb Bush. I'm not sure the nation is ready for a third candidate, a third president, with the same name. This is not a family thing.
But wasn't he supposed to be number two?
Yeah, but that doesn't make any difference.
No, it doesn't matter now. But I think he would have made a much better president.
But he's somebody who talks about things that could help the Republicans expand their base. You know, his position on immigration is a lot
married
more
a
warm
Latina.
And welcoming mm-hmm. to a lot more people yeah. than most of the other Republicans.
But Kitty, as a political strategist, which you have been among the best, you know that sometimes the issues and where people are on the issues aren't as important as who has electability. And I am not, in this case, who's nominatable. I don't think
that's a good word.
I think who's nominatable versus who's electable. And he might be like so many people have been in the Democratic Party, where he could win the general election, but he's got to win his own primary first.
That's true.
Yeah.
I'll turn to Dan Mueller. Where do you come down on Rick Perry? On a record as a governor of a very successful state, and you're a big pro-business guy, shouldn't he be doing a lot better than he apparently is at the moment?
Yes, he should, and he's not doing better because he's inarticulate. I don't think it's right in his DNA to believe a lot of the things that, for instance, Marco Rubio does or Scott Walker. Those guys live and breathe what they're saying. I think that
Governor Perry
is he has got a very good record down there for economic development. He's done a lot on so many issues, but it's not something that he can call on in a fight and it comes up.
Does Donald Trump at this moment represent one of the best things Hillary Clinton has going for her, Kitty?
Oh, he is our dream. He is our dream. If Donald Trump were even to stay in long enough to be in a few debates, the Democrats
don't you
will
think he's going to be?
Wild.
Cliff, do you think he sticks around for some
debates?
I'm not
certain he's going to file his financial paperwork.
No, he hasn't done that. That's
and
the only
I don't
thing.
Think he's going to file right. all of the stuff that he He'll, needs to file in the next.
He'll be in the debates.
Days.
He'll be in the debates.
He'll be in the debates.
I think he will too.
I'll bet you lunch,
right.
Dan.
I say 25 cents, but I'll
Does he, by bringing up some issues, I mean, some of the things that he has said about Mexico and specifically Mexicans in his announcement were startling. But, you know, there may be a lot of people in the Republican primary that like that. That's the ultimate red meat. But it seems to me that it destroys any attempt that the Republicans hey, right? would have in trying to do something to reach out to the Hispanic community.
Well, I totally concur with that. I tell you one thing, though, when you're talking about ACA, the Affordable Care Act, one of the things that should have been done, Quentin Young, for instance, Dr. Quentin Young, who's just a great
I'm going to have to interrupt you for a moment. Okay. I'm going to let you figure up, follow up on that in right. hour number two. 1-800-723-8029 is the telephone number. We'll take more calls when we continue. If you're watching this program on television, we'll see you next week. If you're listening to us on radio, another full hour coming up after Network News. From Chicago, this is Bruce Dumont with our Beyond the Beltway analysis of national politics, featuring occasional injections of rumor and innuendo, all offered up by our panel of political insiders, pundits, power brokers, public servants, professors, and most importantly, plain-speaking Americans from coast to coast. Tonight featuring commentary by Clifford Kelly of WVON Radio, Democratic political consultant Kitty Kurth, Dan Mueller of the Heartland Institute, and Ed Bernayne, former Reagan advanced man and political operative. Our phone lines remain open at 1-800-723-8029, but I understand we're having some phone problems, so if you want to email me a comment, it is bruce.dumont@museum.tv. We're going to put that number or that address for those listening on the World Wide Web. If you'd like to email us a comment, give us send us an email, BruceDumont@museum.tv. And if you want to tweet us a question, it's @Dumo. And again, we've been talking a little bit about the events of this past week, and it has been a monumental week in American politics, and we'll continue to talk about that, because some of the things that happened this past week, in many cases, it represents some of the monumental things that we have discussed in the history of this program. You know, we talked about the rise of the Reagan Revolution, the fall of communism, 9/11. I mean, just so many things. The emergence of same-sex marriage and gay rights in the last 35 years. Just the monumental things that have happened. In addition to the natural disasters, the school shootings, the devastation of school shootings, and gun violence in the country as it has unfolded over the last 35 years. One thing in thinking about sort of setting up this particular broadcast is the cyclical nature of a lot of what we've talked about, issues that come and they go away. I guess the monumental issue that got some significant change was welfare reform. I think probably in the next 35 years it may be criminal justice reforms. Hopefully we don't have to wait 35 years for it. But again, the program began as an opportunity to talk about politics, a no-holds-barred discussion, a robust discussion of politics, if you will. And again, we're going to share with you right now, and this goes, you know, to try to put 35 years into a short piece. It is not easy. It's not meant to be all-inclusive, but it is meant to be some of the high points in the history of this program, which began on June 26th of 1980. And again, you are about to hear in this short montage, you will hear the host's voice change and evolve. And so let us turn back the clock to June 26th of 1980 and listen to this montage, 35 years of Inside Politics and Beyond the Beltway.
Thursday, June 26th, 1980. This past week in politics, the war between Mayor Byrne and the Chicago Tribune heated up. Ronald Reagan seized control of the tax cut issue, and the IVI IPO endorsed Bernard Carey's bid for re-election. Well, tonight on Inside Politics, we'll explore these stories and also take the political career of Illinois Attorney General Bill Scott. Good evening, everybody. I'm your host, Bruce Dumont, and this is the first in a series of programs, and we thank you very much for joining us this evening. And joining us this evening on our premiere broadcast to discuss the week in politics, we have Bill Cameron, political editor of WMAQ Radio. Also joining us this evening, we have Phil Crone, who for the past few years has been one of the leading political strategists for local Democrats. And our third guest this evening is Thomas Roser, Vice President Government Relations for the Quaker Oats Company.
Let's turn to national politics. At the beginning of the program, one of the topics I said that we would discuss this evening is Ronald Reagan's seizure of the tax cut issue. Do you think he has been successful in that, or is it too early to tell, Tom Rosen?
Well, I think a way that he has handled the compromise between the Art Laffers and the Friedmans on that and came in with a tax cut which goes in a series of steps is astute.
Gentlemen, let us begin. Let's put Mayor Byrne right up the front of the burner tonight and find out how you feel about her move to move into the Cabrini Green housing project. Sheldon Gardner, what do you
really
think of the
marvelous
idea?
It's marvelous when in the same week you can appoint two anti-busing people to the school board and move into Cabrini Green. She really is a noble successor to Mayor Daley, who can play both ends against the middle. It was a very, very clever ploy.
Last Monday, shooting of President Reagan sent shockwaves throughout America, and Alexander Haig's conduct at the height of the drama has resulted in severe criticism.
Tom Roser, what's your thoughts on the political horizon for the president as a result
I think
of the shooting?
The way that the man has reacted to the assassination attempt, almost like Duke Wayne walking in the emergency room, as somebody said, almost biting on the bullet and saying, okay, handle this thing. It is a scenario that I think is brilliant so far as politics is concerned. He's a great survivor.
And, of course, this is a historic broadcast in that tomorrow
in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. They will be issuing same-sex marriage licenses. The media of the world are here in Massachusetts covering what's going to be transpiring. In fact, beginning at midnight tonight, there are some municipalities who are going to be issuing licenses. To many people listening around the country, this issue is going to be over tomorrow. But the reality is it's just starting. The fight has just begun, is it not?
Oh, absolutely. You know, this. First of all, these aren't real marriages. No, you know, I mean, the law can say, yes, they're married, but they're not married.
Okay, let's go to Linda, listening to us on Cogo in San Diego. You're on the air.
I totally support gay marriage. I'm an estate planning attorney. I understand the legal issues. I don't understand why you said it's unhealthy, because so far I haven't been listening to any facts to support why it's unhealthy.
One of the concerns, obviously, of those that oppose it, they expect that this is the beginning and this is going to roll across the countryside. Do you think that's likely to happen? What we're witnessing in the state of Massachusetts in 5 or 10 years from now, are we going to be talking about 30 or 40 states that are engaged in the same type of activity?
What do you think?
We are coming to you from the beautiful Howard Johnson's Lodge in Manchester, New Hampshire. Tom Roser will agree with something that I'm about to say. We both heard Bill Clinton this afternoon. It was one of the best political presentations I've seen in a long, long time.
Do you believe that Bill Clinton is still electable as president of the United States? Not nominatable, electable.
Anybody that knows anything about this game, from the professionals, frankly, to the electorate, know. As sad as it is, and Bill Clinton is a friend of mine. I've known Bill Clinton for a long time, and I admire him as a person. The fact of the matter, however, is that Bill Clinton is no longer. The Republicans are salivating over Bill Clinton being the nominee. He is not electable.
3 or 4 months ago, before the convention, I think Steve and I, you know, we chatted about it. If you talk to most political pros, they thought that Al Gore was going to select Senator Bob Graham of Florida to be his running mate. And I'll tell you right now, if Graham had been the running mate, Al Gore would have carried Florida.
Right, and been the next president.
And I was a little bit stupefied that when I was, watching, switching around at least, you know, after midnight last night to the major networks, very few people uttered a word about the fact that Jeb Bush is the governor of Florida, and he obviously is George W. Bush's brother. Where is he at the moment, and are people keeping a close eye on him?
He is in a back room hovering over a mimeograph machine, cranking out ballots as quickly as possible. No, I'm just kidding.
Let us begin with Know and Tell. That's where we ask each guest to share with us for the first time something that they know that they now want to tell, and we begin this week with Kenneth McCarthy.
Bruce, in a real interesting turn in Washington, super spouse Hillary, after being ordered by a federal judge to hold the task force meetings in public, has filed an appeal to overturn the ruling, but nonetheless plans to openly defy the ruling anyway.
Grace Domenkowitz.
It is about the dirty trick right wing of the Republican Party, which hasn't learned its lesson that bashing Hillary Rodham Clinton.
What does it take to start something?
Honey, what's the best vacation we've ever had?
This one.
Bradenton, Anna Maria Island, Longboat Key. Real, authentic, Florida. Plan to visit online at bradentongulfislands.com.
Moment from the Beyond the Beltway archives.
Let's get to the big, big story, and that is the fall of the Communist Party. Tom Roser?
It was the liberals which were saying, well, we've got to stand by Gorbachev. I know why Democratic liberals like Gorby. It's because he reminds
them
of the little Duke.
Ray,
this guy is a guy who went to the Soviet Union and, in fact, when he was captured, didn't
believe
do anything.
You.
So that's why he looks like the little Duke to them.
Beyond the Beltway with Bruce Dumont. Still going strong after 35 years.
Bruce Dumont back. Thanks very much for joining us tonight. I want to talk about getting back to some of the issues that we talked about in hour number one. One of the big events was the three terrorist attacks on three continents at the same time. The nation is on special alert tonight based on reports that there may be an attack sometime over the 4th of July. The intelligence communities of this country and around the world, but primarily this country, are very concerned that there will be a continuation of whether it's copycat terrorist attacks, lone wolves, that are going to seize this moment and build on the momentum of Bloody Friday when attacks in Tunisia and Lyon, France, and in Kuwait City. Dan Miller, I guess one of the monumental things that has evolved in the history of this program, and I referenced it in the broadcast we did from Stockholm, Sweden, is that what happened on September 11th did effectively, dramatically change the way we live our lives. Is there anything that you see on the horizon that is likely to make our lives a little safer in the years to come, or are we going to be sort of living somewhat in fear?
The second, Bruce, I'm quite sure of that. I think we're, as a country, feeling our way through the balance between personal freedom and supervision by the federal government and monitoring of our personal lives. I don't think we've come up with anything yet. Well, yes, we have come up with something in that there has been no further attacks of that kind of nature as 9/11 on American soil, so there has been some success for it. But no, I don't think that we as a nation are done with increasing the encroachment by federal agencies over our personal lives, our privacy.
And Cliff, again, one of the big issues, certainly over the last couple of years, has been the issue of the National Security Agency, mm-hmm. The Patriot Act, the battle over the Patriot Act.
Right.
But yet we see these incidents, and it seems to me that a vast majority of the American people still want to be protected. There's
exactly.
People that are concerned, and they want to be protected from their government. But most of all, the vast majority want to be protected from some enemy that's going to kill them.
Well, you're right, Bruce. And one of the unfortunate things we just saw a couple of weeks ago, how many people have gone through the airport that had things that they
right.
weren't supposed to have, they didn't catch them. 90% of those people who got on those planes had something that they weren't supposed to have, but notwithstanding that fact, they didn't catch them. That's horrific. I think that's a terrible thing. I'm not anymore, but I was one of the chairs of the ACLU, and we've talked about the
right.
the Patriot Act a lot. But we have to have protection. And I agree that, you know, when you've got the situation now, how they can reach everybody, and you've got some guy here that's got nothing going for him, and you're hearing something from ISIS saying, oh, yes, you can do this, you can do that. They don't care.
But, Cliff,
yeah.
just the fact that there has been no attacks such as 9/11 on American soil,
mm-hmm.
that indicates that there has been an effective system for protecting us.
And that's
us.
Fine.
Now,
mm-hmm.
are
But I'm just saying that we have a greater threat now, and I think that's what Bruce was suggesting. We have a different we have these guys. You don't have to work out. 9/11 was a big deal the way they did it, mm-hmm. all right? But you don't have to do that anymore. You can be sitting on the beach like the guy walks up with a gun and starts shooting people. That's what I'm concerned about.
Or a shopping mall.
Right, exactly.
And with the ability with social media now, and again,
that's
just,
the problem.
I'm going to give you a horror. I'm going to give you a horror scenario right now.
Okay.
With social media, how many? And again, I don't mean to be disparaging all cab drivers, but I want to put it in context. There's a lot of people when you get into a taxi cab.
Right.
They are from foreign countries. Most of them, at least in a major city, they're from foreign countries. Many of them are from the Middle East.
So?
A social media campaign that would be directed towards cab drivers, that at a certain moment, at a certain time, wherever they are in the world,
mm-hmm.
they pull out a gun and they shoot their passenger.
And it's
what sort of terror would that rain?
Well, it would be horrible. Of course it would. But what makes you think that that is part of the terror mentality?
Because I think the goal of a terrorist is to absolutely scare the bejesus out of us and make us so fearful that we don't want to go out of our houses, or we don't want to go to movie theaters, or we don't want to go to a shopping mall. Or, again,
or even to church.
Church.
Well,
now, what was reported today is that in Tunisia, that beach – the bloody beach from Friday,
right.
people were still out on the beach. So the point is the American people have to continue to do what they're doing no matter what happens. But it doesn't mean that there aren't going to be continuing efforts by people to ruin our lives and make make us think twice about the simplest things that we do.
But maybe one of these days we need to get down to thinking about the causes of terror and why the people who are joining ISIS are joining ISIS, and why the people who
and what's
are
the answer to that question?
I'm getting there. Who are anti-immigrants are anti-immigrants, and why the people like the kid who shot the people in Charleston are haters. It's the people who are alienated, who feel largely young men, who are alienated, feel they have no future of their own, they have no jobs, and they have nothing to look forward to. And that is a similarity across all of the different kinds of hate that are evinced, you know, the guys who are joining ISIL and the guy in Charleston.
I think that's a particularly good point, because if we start looking at this as if it were religious inspired, and I know Islam is a major motivating factor, but the fact is what really unites these terrorist actions is the strategy, the technique, as you said, Bruce.
And they learn from one another, even though, it's odd in Europe, the people who are anti-Muslim and anti-Semitic are – anti-Jewish and anti-Muslim are sometimes the same people, but it's all this hate motivation, and it's largely male, largely young, who see that they have no future themselves.
No, but again, it isn't all that, because those that flew the planes into the – many of them came from wealthy families or upper-middle-class families, and of all the terrorist attacks that took place last Friday – one of the scariest, I think, was the attack on the mosque in Kuwait City. I mean, because that was a Shiite mosque.
Yeah.
Because
right.
Now you're dealing with Shia Shiite battles.
Yeah.
And if that explodes, that religious battle can make anything that's happened thus far look like child's play. Mm-hmm. And that could break out in all the capitals of the world. Maybe we could sit back and maybe we feel a little bit safer because that's an internal battle within that part of the world. But it's going to affect us all.
Absolutely, it's going to affect us. Yeah.
I think we have backed away, and we have become less concerned about what is happening around the world than what is happening right here. And I think the ISIL situation is such that we cannot just look at what's going on over there and not think it's going to happen here. I mean, 9/11 when you look back, it was a carefully strategized or carefully planned, but it was an easy thing for them to do,
yes,
really.
Sure.
And the same thing, and we've got thousands of young men, maybe not so young, but who have a hatred towards not just the United States, but towards some of the European countries or others. And we have to increase the security net that we have. I think we have to become more active, and maybe it means that we're going to have to send more troops other parts of the world to show them that you're not going to get away with this.
And yet we live in a country that doesn't like to hear the term boots on the ground. It is quite a courageous – do you think that the inevitability of boots on the ground somewhere, someplace to fight ISIS, is that a fact of life?
I think so. That's the only way you just can't bomb people. Somebody's got to come in there.
Yeah.
And take over that area. And the way things are going now, you know, we've made so many mistakes. If we hadn't taken out Gaddafi, we wouldn't be having the problem. He didn't have any weapons of mass destruction. I mean, if I lived in that neighborhood, I'd want people to think I had it too. Mm-hmm. You know, he didn't have anything. We did that. Wouldn't have had the problems if we hadn't taken out Gaddafi in Libya.
Yeah, yeah.
Totally different situation. We've been with the wrong people and doing the wrong things to these folks. They don't like us. We're going to have some major problems.
Well, they also don't like it. The point is, and this goes back to the early part of the discussion, is they don't like us because we are who we are. And so, do they not like us? You know, when the Supreme Court of the great Satan nation says that men can marry men and women can marry women, that doesn't play well in that part of the world. A female president who wears pantsuits, that doesn't play real well in that part of the world. I mean, we are a free nation. We act freely. And because of that, a lot of people in the rest of the world do not like us, including Vladimir Putin. I mean, Vladimir Putin's position on, you know, on gay and lesbian issues. I mean, that's he's in the Reverend Phelps category almost.
And Putin is very, very happy that we are all worried about ISIL and ISIS, and no one is looking at what he's doing.
That's right.
Up in Norway and Greenland and in the Arctic, and all of the troops he's putting up there, and all of the oil exploration that he's doing on land that is not his. Right. He's very happy.
Well, you know, you can't even join the armed services now. A lot of people, you know, used to say, well, but we've helped a lot of folks who were in bad shape. But you can't even, you have to have a high school diploma now to get in the armed services. And I understand that because, like when I was in the service, you know, we had a lot of people who didn't have a lot going for them, but they were able to handle whatever was necessary, particularly in Nam. But boots on the ground is necessary.
1-800-723-8289. I'm Bruce Dumont.
A great moment from the Beyond the Beltway archives.
July 16th, 1980 is a day that not many people in this auditorium will ever forget. For on this night, delegates from all over the United States gathered to endorse the candidacy of Ronald Reagan, nominated with 1,939 votes from this convention floor, the Joe Louis Arena in Detroit, Michigan. And what we see here today perhaps is the beginning of a new wave as we move into the 1980s. The Republicans throughout this convention has referred to this as their 1932, the turning point in American political history. Perhaps the story is being written here this evening. This certainly is chapter one.
Beyond the Beltway with Bruce Dumont, still going strong after 35 years.
Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Thank you very much for joining us tonight. 1-800-723-8289. Also at Dumo, at D-U-M-O, if you want to tweet us a comment. Around the table this evening, and I'm going to say a little bit more about these people. Clifford Kelly is here. He is one of the original panel members on the program called Inside Politics, which became Beyond the Beltway in 1995 when the Republicans took over Congress in 94. It was a transformative moment, and so we changed the name of the program, although we used the term Beyond the Beltway in the very first national show we ever did. Cliff Kelly was a longtime member of the Chicago City Council, is now a talk show host. And again, for those listening around the country, because in the first segment we did talk about the Supreme Court decision on same-sex marriage, and as a member of the Chicago City Council, you were the person who introduced the first gay rights ordinance in the city of Chicago in what year?
That, Bruce, was 1973.
And it was then a pretty remarkable thing for you to do. You had a you're African American, for those you know listening around the country.
Right.
Your constituency was 99% African American. There was a lot of ministers then and even now, black ministers are part of the chorus against the concept of same-sex marriage. You took a lot of heat for the decision that you made. When you look back on the decision you made, and then you juxtapose that to the decision of the Supreme Court, do you have some great sense of satisfaction that you were
really
so far ahead of the curve?
I really do, because I was shocked to see, Bruce, how quickly things happened. I just didn't come out and do this. Back in 73, I was a member of the Democratic Platform Committee.
1973.
And I was a member of the Platform Committee, and some gentlemen came to testify before the committee who were members of the Illinois Gays for Legislative Action, five lawyers, and they made a great presentation. And I knew it wasn't going anywhere, but I went out and talked to them during a break, and I said, listen, I know a lot of the young progressive members of the legislature. Let me talk to them. You know, and they said, oh, fine, would you do that? And I said, sure. And I was disappointed to find that everyone I talked to that I thought might want to do it, because it shouldn't have been through the city, it should have been through the state anyway, they all said, we'll vote for it, but we're not going to introduce it. So that's why I did it in the city council, because I said, yeah, we have home rule power, and, you know, if we do it here, then the state will do it. But the thing that has amazed me, Bruce, is how quickly And I wasn't talking about same-sex marriage. I was just talking about rights to, to gay people.
Right.
But the politicians didn't do this. It was the people
was
that
the
did
people.
This. Absolutely.
It was the people that did it.
That is the reason it went so fast. If this was political, it was up to the politicians.
Well, even the, I mean, even the president, Hillary Clinton, up until a few years ago, they didn't think it was doable. And
well, Obama was against it.
Obama ran as an opponent.
I know.
But all of a sudden, he turns around.
It takes a long time once they get the read the tea leaves. Mm-hmm. But again, I would be remiss again since this is an issue that obviously is getting a great deal of exposure. Again, in Chicago today is Gay Pride, part of the Gay Pride parade was today and the weekend. But again, I think one of those that was involved with Clifford Kelly in lobbying in the early years and really for about almost three decades was a media go-to guy that everybody would go to. And he passed away literally in the last couple of months, and that was William Kelly, who was very involved in that group.
Great guy.
He did not live to see the decision. And again, for those listening around the country, some local people will know this, is that my late wife, Kathy Osterman, also was a sponsor of the Gay Rights Ordinance, Human Rights Ordinance,
they
changed the name to it,
right.
Ultimately did pass in the Chicago City Council, supported by a lot of people, including Ed Burke and a lot of people that she was able to bring over. I want to introduce now Dan Miller. And Dan Miller, for many years, you were with the Chicago, the Crane Chicago Business, Crane Chicago City and State, the business editor of the Chicago Sun-Times, and now very active with the Heartland Institute. And again, we go back a long way, and also someone that has sat in and hosted this show while I was away. And thank you for your friendship over the years. You're one of the best.
My goodness, Bruce. Are you suggesting that the change in public attitude towards same-sex influence the Supreme Court in their decision?
I think to some extent, I think it did. I think the reaction is that, you know, when we had political leaders in the gay community, they, including Rick Garcia, who was a frequent guest on this program, I think even he was surprised that the issue of civil unions, that they were content with civil unions for a while.
Correct.
But the people were moving on this. And part of it was when the opposition was moving to have bans of gay marriage on certain ballots, including in Ohio. Again, this was part of a strategy by Karl Grove to turn out the evangelical vote in 2004 for George Bush. The point is, the fact that they organized, it caused the other side to wake up and organize. And basically, in this particular case, this is a perfect case of one side really out-organizing the opposition. Kitty Kurth.
I think it's also a sea change, a generational sea
Absolutely.
Change.
Absolutely.
I think, you know, all of the younger people that I talk to, it's just, they just don't understand how you would ever stop someone from getting married. It's kind of how I felt as a young child when Loving versus Virginia was there. And I was like, what do you mean a black man can't marry a white woman or a white woman and a black? That doesn't make any sense to me. And I think the kids now feel that way about gay marriage.
Let me introduce Ed Murnane. Ed Murnane is with us, also a longtime friend of the Reagan presidency. You were an advanced man. You also worked for the Vice President Bush, very close to the Bush family as well over the years. And again, also a political editor of the Daily Herald, and worked for the late, great Phil Crane, one of the conservative stalwarts of Congress, who passed away a number of years ago. And also, one of the things that I think I've shared before, but I want to share it with you on the air, because I want to thank you on the air for giving me one of the greatest pieces of advice, because we've known each other for, 35 years now, Ed. When Ronald Reagan was the president of the United States, I was working for a show in Chicago, political analyst reporter for Chicago Tonight. Ronald Reagan, for the first time that any president, wanted to hold a national televised presidential press conference from outside Washington. He was going to get out from the beyond the beltway media coverage. And so he had it at the Hyatt Regency O'Hare at O'Hare, right by the airport. If you've ever flown into Chicago, you probably have been there. And I talked to Ed, because Ed was doing advance for that trip for the president. And I said, Ed, I knew I was going to the press conference. What's the key to get recognized by the president? And Ed, tell people the advice you gave me.
Well,
this is turning out better than I thought.
No, it gets better.
I told Bruce where to sit among the media, and I knew where President Reagan was going to be looking. And
always on the aisle. You said he never looked off the aisle.
And I think I probably told you the left side of the aisle, or your left, rather than the right, because the president. And this was a press corps that was not accustomed to being with the president.
That's right.
He was
focusing. We were all local press people.
Local.
Yeah.
And you might have looked at the next press conference the president did and figured out exactly who he was going to ask first, because it was always
So we are in the holding room.
That's great.
They now open the door, and it's an opportunity now for the local press to come in and take their seats. The door opens. I hightail it right for the right seat on the right, and I've got the first seat in about the fifth row. And I'm sitting there, and people are asking the question. And by the way, they brought the national press in, and they put the national press, who usually, you know, they come in with a, you know, like a big fanfare. They all got put in the back of the room because the White House wanted the local people up front. And so people were going back and forth. You also told me he's going to go from the left side to the right side. He goes back and forth and back and forth. So everyone from the local press, they're all asking local questions, parochial questions. I had read going out there that the week coming up was the anniversary of the building of the Berlin Wall. And so about the fifth question in, the president points to me, and I stand up with my voice quivering. I don't have the tape right now. Bruce Dumont, WTTW Chicago. I said, I made some comment about the anniversary of the Berlin Wall. I said, would you ever put the destruction of the Berlin Wall as a condition for future arms limitation talks with the Soviet Union? And he took that question and he knocked it out of the ballpark. And I said, follow up, Mr. President. And I said, by your words, are you worried that maybe you're raising a false hope to the people who live beyond that wall? And he went on again to say that he thought the wall was horrible and it had to come down. And it was, I think, about 4 years later when he gave his famous speech, but again, Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall, and it wasn't because of my question. I know.
Claim credit, Bruce.
Well, I do want to claim credit that the man to my right, Ed Murnane, is the one, and I will say that in my professional career, standing up and asking a question of the sitting president of the United States was really one of the biggest thrills I had. And the fact that it was to Ronald Reagan, and, you know, the answer ended up, in the first five paragraphs of the New York Times story. So,
well, and the question, if we hadn't done that, Bruce, the question might have been, Mr. President, do you think I-55 should be expanded?
I think someone else asked that question. Back shortly from Chicago.
Honey, what's the best vacation we've ever had?
This one.
Bradenton, Anna Maria Island, Longboat Key. Real, authentic, Florida. Plan to visit online at bradentongulfislands.com.
From the Beyond the Beltway archives.
Does pay all his bills, Mr. Reynolds, for his campaign.
Like most people.
And a lot of other, unlike you.
That's a lie.
That is not a lie, and
that's
you owe a lot of money, and I think it's wonderful.
I owe $30,000.
This is the American
system. I owe $30,000. How much do you owe?
I don't know a thing.
That was a cheap, underhanded shot, and you ought to be ashamed of yourself.
That was an overhanded shot.
That was over. You ought to be ashamed of yourself, Roser.
How much do you owe Harvard?
$14,000.
Well, pay it, will you? How much do you make?
I'll pay it. $125,000? I'll get around to paying it.
Beyond the Beltway with Bruce Dumont. Still going strong after 35 years.
Bruce Dumont back. Thanks very much for joining us. Again, this is our last segment. And again, I mentioned that, you know, sort of the monumental things that we've talked about in the history of this program. Dan Miller, again, 35 years is a long time to sort of summarize. Mm. But again, if you were to look back, you know, three decades, is there one political story that you think really has, you know, defined that period?
The issues of the last couple of days, certainly, I can't get my head around them even now. But 30 years ago, Bruce, the prime rate was 21%. The prime rate, the rate that the banks could charge their best customers, their most creditworthy customers, was 21%. Now we're living in a time with interest rates of virtually zero. What has happened, the recognition that inflation is a threat to the United States, its security, its stability, its political structure, that has been a story that I just can't get out of my mind.
Cliff Kelly. 30 years.
Mm-hmm. Well, 30 years. Yeah, the most important thing that's happened to me that I will never forget, of course, is the election and re-election of our first African-American president. Mm-hmm. I didn't think I would see that. I really didn't.
Ed Murnane.
I think the growth of fear in our country, maybe it goes back to 9/11, but it seems as if that has frightened a lot of people. And sometimes, including myself, mm-hmm. and sometimes we get the feeling that we're not really fully prepared or have the mental strength to be prepared to prevent something like that from happening again.
Kitty Kurth, 35-plus years, the monumental either political theme that you think has been the most significant change.
I'm going to go with Cliff's a little bit that Obama is president, but that we have diversity of leadership, and even on the Republican side right. this time, it's not all white men. No offense to the white men at the table, but on both the Democratic side and the Republican side, we know that there's a chance that someone will get into the office that looks different and is different than the other occupants.
I think also, to me, the answer I would put is, again, the rise of Ronald Reagan and the rise of Barack Obama, and also sort of the come-from-nowhere success of Jimmy Carter, and also primarily Bill Clinton. And then also the inevitabilities that never really happened. The inevitability that Ted Kennedy was going to knock off Jimmy Carter. The inevitability that Hillary Clinton was going to
be president,
was just going to throw this guy, Barack Obama, under the bus. These are some of the things. I thank our guests this evening. And these are some of the guests and faces we've heard for the last 35 years. Good night, everybody.